Hello and welcome to the Coast to Coast College Admissions Podcast. Each week, we talk about different college admissions topics and answer those tough questions you may be dealing with concerning getting into the college of your choice. We know how difficult this process can be, so each week, we try and make it easier to navigate. Now, here's your host, Anna Wren and Mark Huffer.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to College Admissions with Mark and Anna. We're so excited to have you here today. I'm your host, Anna, with
Mark Huffer.
And we're excited to talk about ROI, return on investment, versus, let's say, picking a school based on name or reputation or rank, and kind of how to weigh these factors out.
Wait, Anna, just a second. We all know that the U.S. News and College, U.S. News and World Report identifies the top 100 colleges, and those are the only ones to apply to, right?
Yes, apparently only the top 100 are good. No, obviously you and I know both that is garbage. But what we will be discussing today are other rankings. And again, I think Mark and I have said before in the past to take rankings with a grain of salt, as they all use different criteria that go into it. But let's talk about why ROI is so hot right now. Or maybe it's been hot all along, Mark.
Yeah, I think ROI has been hot for some people. Yeah, who are probably financially savvy and conscious. But I think because we are approaching $1.6 trillion in debt for college as a nation, I think there are fewer people paying attention to it than should be.
Yes. And I think this is also a generation, if you think, I don't even know which generation are we on. Are we on X, Z, Y? But I think this is also one that grew up with the recession. They are much more money conscious and in certain ways more practical than generations before. So that also might be influencing it as well.
Agreed. I don't know about you, but I've run into the situations where students who are 17 and 18 years old are much more conscious about debt and taking on loans than their parents actually are concerned. And that's, I think, like you say, it's one of those things, the environment that you grow up in and kind of the social information that you hear dictates how you approach money and a lot of those issues.
Absolutely. I had, I'm sure you've had it too, where I've had a student tell me before, like, I got a free ride to XYZ school, but you know, it's not ranked as well as blah, blah, blah. And since my parents are paying it, they've chosen the other school. And I'm like, well, I'm glad, you know, you are so rational and understanding that a full ride is not to be taken lightly.
Absolutely. I think that's one of those, it's that wonderful, mythical free ride that always, when we hear about it and realizing that there are very few colleges that you're going to get a free ride on if you are actually the norm or average student. That free ride thing, I always have to laugh a little bit.
It's the unicorn, right?
It is the unicorn, indeed.
So let's talk a little bit about ROI and what it is, in case people don't know what it is.
Sure. And one of the things, I think it's important to identify why the ROI, or return on investment, is an important thing to consider when you're looking at colleges and who you are going to apply to. And I think one of the big things that students have to realize, we all know that the percentage of people who actually work in the area of their major once they graduate is actually pretty small. But we also know that those people who do graduate in a particular major, research has shown that about 40% of graduates actually make less salary than anticipated. So when you're looking at how much you pay for school versus how much you make after you graduate, you also have to understand that for 40% of people, it's actually less than you're going to estimate. So that return on investment is also further skewed. When you look at return on investment, Anna, what are the major pieces to consider?
I think there's a lot of things to consider, right? So I think one of it is, like, for the amount of money you're putting in, which is tuition, or actually I would say total cost of attendance, how much debt are you going to incur? And then I would say on top of that, as reminded to me by a friend of mine, she's like, I wish I'd known that the major I had chosen would only make X money a year, because then I would have realized it would be near impossible to pay off the debt I owed with the income I would have yielded doing that major.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the conversations that a lot of counselors really need to have with not only students, but parents as well. And that's, you know, how much is a particular field anticipate to make on graduation and probably over the next 5 to 10 years, so that you can put that relative to how much it's going to cost you to go to school. And that relative or return on investment, like you mentioned, there are a lot of little pieces that I don't think people necessarily put into that equation when they're putting schools down on their list.
Right. And in addition, I would say to return on investment in terms of money, because that's usually how we talk about it, mm-hmm. is time. Are there certain programs or certain schools where it will take you less time to graduate, or it might take you the same amount of time to graduate, but maybe you'll graduate with 2 degrees, like a master's in addition to a bachelor's, or will you be able to diversify, which I think is also important in terms of picking up 2 majors, so that I usually tell kids, like, one that you really just want, like you love learning for the sake of learning. And we would love it ideally that that coincides with how much money they'll make in the future, but that is not always the case. And so the other one I often say is just one as a backup, so that if you get out and for some reason you need to make money right away, that you can do that.
I think we've talked about that in What Are Your Cooking Skills? Always have that as a backup plan.
Yes, yes. Well, sometimes chefs make really good money.
No kidding. Yeah. They work really hard, but they do make money, and they can usually find a job. That's actually one of those things to have in your back pocket for sure.
That's actually another great point, though, you bring up, Mark, is not only the salary of the job you're looking at to consider, but how likely is it? What are the job prospects or openings available in that job?
Well, and added layer to that, not only are those available, but I think one of the other conversations that's part of this that students really need to understand, if you get an engineering degree, that's great. But you also have to understand the lifestyle of a starting engineer once you get out of school. It is usually quite I think a lot of engineers are surprised that their weekends suddenly go away and they're called work days. So I think that's another part of that equation, return on investment and picking majors. And I think it's important to have early on when you're describing what kind of major you want to study for and what kind of school you want to go to.
Yes, yes, that's a great point. So let's start with, there's so many topics out there. Let's break it down for them. So yeah. In terms of debt, what should they be looking at? What should they be considering?
For terms of debt, I think the big ones for me, I think that often get thrown by the wayside. It's basically those things that run into your cost of attendance. But also, when you talk about cost of attendance, the types of loans that are often in an offer letter, and often people think that it's part of that mythical free full ride. And those are the loans and the kinds of interest rates that are associated with them, and whether they're compounding while you're in school or after. And I think that part of the return on investment, people don't initially factor that in, as that is actually something you have to pay back. It's not that you're getting that money for free.
Yes, that is a great point. I actually, I saw a mom had posted and asked a question about how much money is a monthly payment for someone who, for example, borrows, let's say, $20,000over the life of 4 years for college, which is actually not bad, Mark, right? Let's be honest.
Oh, absolutely. $20,000 is something that can be paid back in a relatively shorter period of time, depending on how much you can save and in which occupation you're in.
That's a great point. And so I chimed in, and I don't mind sharing that I had I have a debt that is under 20K, but is close. for all 4 years. And then I actually had something called a subsidized loan, which means that it does not accrue interest while I am in college. And I think the life of my loan is 15 years. So that's not bad, Mark, right?
Oh, absolutely.
But I was honest. So I was like, oh, my payment's a little bit like around 160 to 170 a month. But I think the crazy part is like for a teenager or not a teenager, but a college student even, they're like, oh, that's not so bad. I could totally do that. But I think the scary part is you don't realize how much you end up paying in the long run. Because of that interest, you pay, like, for example, let's say an extra $10,000. What could you have done with that $10,000, right? Absolutely. And that's on a loan of, let's say, 20 grand.
Yep. Well, and the thing is, one of the things my wife, as you know, she's a financial advisor, and she says that one of the most important things that high school students graduate understanding is compound interest. And much to your point, if you have a $20,000 debt, you have to remember that as you're paying that off, just like you're paying off a house or a car, the loan that you took out continues to compound even while you're paying on that debt until you get to the principal. So that's one thing to understand, that and how long, like you said, the life of your loan is 15 years. But if you have somebody who's graduating from medical school and they have racked up $300,000, $400,000 of debt, even at the salary that they are possibly going to make, they may be paying off their debt for 20 years. And that is a whole different can of worms.
Yes, that is true. And so I think that's why it's so important to, I feel like some parents avoid the conversation about debt and borrowing money. But I think that's why it's so important that you have that conversation. And the other thing I think some parents didn't realize is that students can sign up on their financial package to take that loan, whether their parents agree to or not.
Right. I mean, yeah, you can, as it might be so unfortunately identified as sign your life away without somebody who really understands or has counseled you on what it means that you're signing. And that's when it gets a little bit scary, when you realize that a teenager has signed something, they're basically signing on to an agreement that they may not fully understand. That's scary.
Yes, that is true. So I think, you know, it's important to have these real conversations with kids, right? What's the next thing we want to talk about?
Okay, well, one of the things is identifying, I think, basically, not only identifying the return of investment of particular schools, but also, like you said, how long are you going to be in school is another part of that equation. And I think, you know, if you're going to continue into a lot of different occupations, a master's is considered the new bachelor degree. So your return on investment also has to include that time and financial expenditure for a master's degree. That's really common in engineering, and I encourage students who are looking at engineering or almost any of the STEMs occupations that they're pretty much looking at a minimum of 6 years and pulling in that master's degree to be competitive in the workforce.
That's a great point. So investment in terms of, you know, additional education. Like I know I'll post a link on our page, but you know, in terms of the discrepancy between what you earn with a bachelor's versus a master's, and again, even not all, I would say not all bachelors are created equal either, right, Mark? But so there is a white paper out there called What's It Worth, released by Georgetown University a few years ago, and engineering is one of those where they are the highest, so estimated $75,000 a year graduating. But if you do the master's, it's, you know, six figures.
Yeah.
And the next one after that is computers and mathematics. So as you can see, STEM is leading the way. And then after that is business. And then, so you can see, and after that, healthcare. But you can see that to get to the next page, right? So for example, if you're making 75 grand and then to make 100 grand, you know, that's $25,000, let's say a year extra you'd be making, but it's going to cost you some money to do that, right? So then you just have to factor in, well, how long, right, will it take to pay back?
Exactly. And that's one of the things I work with. As you know, I work with a lot of students who are in STEM or focused on STEM careers. And since I've worked with and hired a lot of engineers, I encourage students to not only get the master's, but look at that as basically an investment on not only their education, but also on their employability. And the reason why, much like you said, you may start at $75,000 if you have a bachelor's, and that's great money. However, putting in that extra 18 months to 2 years on a specific area and becoming really well-grounded in a particular area can make you much more employable, so you'll get a better job. You'll also get higher starting pay, but even more importantly, you will actually be on a higher trajectory, a steeper trajectory for more bonuses and more pay quicker. So yes, you will spend a little bit more time in school, and yes, you will pay a little bit more money, but you will gain it back faster than you would have if you hadn't gone.
That's a great point. I think it's similar for MBAs too, because I work with, you know, students that are interested in business. But I would also say, like, in business, it's a little different, because if you're in certain areas like finance or accounting, you can get your CFA or CPA, and sometimes that can become more valuable than an MBA. Depending on your background, and it's a test and studying versus a whole graduate degree in terms of investment.
Agreed. I think there are a lot more students who are looking at getting a degree in a particular area and getting an MBA, a JD, something that actually is not necessarily associated with their particular field, but employers find out that those areas of expertise added to that original degree can make them very valuable in the workplace. So that's another route that some students are taking.
That's true. So let's talk a little bit about what can influence return on investment.
There are a lot of things that can influence it, but I think the major ones that I think students really need to focus on when they're considering schools and what they're going to study. First of all, I think what you study and how you go about asking yourself, what are your passions? What are you interested in? What are your particular areas of expertise and talents in academia, and how you like working with people, so that you can really go into college with not a perfect idea of what you're going to end up doing for the rest of your life, because that's ridiculous, but having an idea of what kind of area you should be studying. And I think that's, if you don't have that going in, the return on investment equation and that conversation is very difficult to have, because that variable is undefined.
That's a great point. And also, you could spend a lot of time trying to figure it out in college.
Oh yeah.
Which could significantly influence how much you're paying for school. So, you know, that definitely influences cost of attendance. But I think along with that, I've seen some parents, you know, if you have a high achieving student, you know, if they do get AP credit, sometimes that can reduce how much money you're putting in. Your child could choose to graduate a year early. And I have seen fellow classmates do that before and get in. And there's savings, and it affects, I would say, ROI in two ways when you do something like that. Not only do you graduate and save a year's worth of tuition, but you're getting into the workforce earlier as well.
Exactly.
So you're accruing that experience and that salary a little earlier too. So, you know, Mark, I totally agree with you. It's really important to try and figure out as much as you can what you're interested in doing.
It's interesting you mentioned the graduating early. I think that's one thing that we're always amazed when those students who grab the opportunity by the horns and really focus, and they spend 3 years and you know, graduate a year early and are into the workforce. And then I also, in the back of my mind, I don't know if you do this, and I think this is probably as we get older, we go, you know, yes, you've graduated early, but have you done it and added so much stress to your life and had no social life and possibly had a, you know, missed chances to develop in ways and had opportunities that would have been available had you taken it a little bit slower. And that's a whole different kind of return on investment.
That's true. And in certain fields, it's the time you spend with people is just as important as what you're learning in the classroom. So being an undergrad business student myself, you know, connections and networking is really important. So being with certain friends or building those connections is important. And I think I had a classmate who graduated a year early, but what I thought was, and I think he was able to do it because he had a lot of AP credit coming in, so he didn't have to cram. But what I did think was interesting is he really like lived it up the 3 years he was in college and built those connections so that he really maximized both on the personal front and the academic front, so that he could come out and really kind of give himself a head start in the professional world.
Yeah, for sure. If you are one of those people who have a plan and are strategic in the way you approach college and you are intentional in the classes and the way that you spend your free time, you can definitely make 3 years much more productive than some people make six. So I think you are exactly right. If you know kind of how to play the game and get the most out of it, that is definitely the way to approach college.
Yes. And I think the other thing is like talking about how much money you're going to make afterwards, right?
Yeah, and that's one of those, you know, there are so many pieces to that puzzle as well. When you have an average national amount that a particular occupation is going to make for, say, like a new graduate, that average includes those people who are working in areas where it pays more and geographically in areas where it pays less. And that's one thing it's rarely talked about. Are you willing to move to an area that may not be something appealing to you? Or are you really set on working in one particular area and get paid less? So I think that is one of those components of the return on investment after you graduate. Where are you willing to work that a lot of people don't consider?
That's a great point. Like I know I used to work for an energy company. And they would like really pay a lot of money to students that were willing to move out west, like the Dakotas.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there are states now that are actually, you know, they are on the web and actively promoting, we will pay you X to just come and start a business in our state. And I think that is a mark of the times in that. There are areas that will pay for people to come work and start businesses in an area that has previously maybe not been held with the highest regard.
That's a great point. And also I would say in terms of location, not just like where they're going to go afterwards for work, but, you know, depending on the setting of the school you attend, you might be able to take advantage of opportunities throughout the school year as well.
You are so right. I mean, that is one issue that having run internships, I can tell you without any doubt whatsoever that those students who leverage the internship and lab experience opportunities available to them that are close by, especially in the summer, that sets you up for making, like you said, making those connections and working towards getting the best job possible when you graduate. And that is one of those things where is the school and what kind of opportunities for working in that area, even while you're in school, are there where the school is located? And that's something I don't hear a lot of people talk about.
You're right. And I think that also explains, like, I don't know when you're building your list, but I have quite a few students that tell me, like, I want to be in these major cities. And it is because they're thinking ahead. They're thinking, how can I start? And, you know, back in the day, I'm going to date myself a little bit. All we needed to do was get an internship the summer before we went into our senior year in college, and that was sufficient for your resume. Yeah. But nowadays, kids start way earlier.
Well, and not only earlier, I mean, and now working with high school students, I actually encourage them to find opportunities in their home city where they can possibly start to try out and maybe rule out particular occupations or areas of study. And if they do latch on to those not only networking and experience opportunities, they can actually leverage those into internships when they're a freshman in college. And I can tell you that those internships actually get better and better as you have more people willing to say that you're the real deal and have those skills that are valuable to a company. And what that happens after that is by the time you are a senior, you have this actual track record of performance and people who have written recommendations. And that's the way you get a really good job right upon graduation.
That's a good point. So how can a family try to figure out ROI of a school?
Well, I mean, I use a couple of tools, and I'm curious to hear your versions as well. I mean, the two tools that I really like to use are collegedata.com. That's one of the major ones that I use. And basically, they list, cost of attendance. And it also lists some of the components of how much money they give away traditionally for merit and how much of student need, financial need that they cover, gives those percentages. And one of the other things that that site has is how many people are graduating on time, which is another, like you said, factor in the time that you're going to take to graduate. If, only 20% of students are graduating in 4 years, that's not a good sign. So that's something to factor into that as well. But that's one site I use that helps me get some of those numbers that I think are critical in identifying return on investment.
That's a great one. I think they pull the data from College Data, but I use a planning resource for my students. Well, they use it too, called Custom College Plan, and it has all that information in there as well. But I think some other things are, Mark and I are not a huge fan of rankings and lists, but both Forbes and Payscale, as well as bestcolleges.com, have a few lists on schools that provide best ROI or value, perceived value. So it's interesting. For example, I know you work with STEM kids. We have a local tech school. And they're not necessarily well-ranked on U.S. News and World Report. They're not poorly ranked either, but they are well-ranked in terms of value and ROI. And I think it has a lot to do with partially how well they prepare their students academically, but partially because of their location, because they are located literally 15 minutes from downtown New York City. Yep. So it's so easy for their kids to build these relationships and seize internship opportunities and build that resume before they even graduate. So they come out making a good chunk of change. And I think because it is a tech school, they're also limited in what they offer. And because of their offerings, those majors also happen to yield a good ROI, as it were.
Exactly. And you mentioned Forbes, and Forbes is actually one of the resources that I use. I find they're very valuable for not only they actually list return on investment of some schools, and they rank schools according to their estimations of return on investment. But they also are a good source of, they have previously done a couple of different lists where they identify the expected annual salary of particular areas of, for particular professions and those areas where people might have a major and actually end up working. And I think their references and their resources are extremely valuable in teasing some of that out. One of the things I am, it's very sad to me as an educator, whenever you read through one of Forbes' lists, of course, they're going to list those schools where one of my favorite schools is Harvey Mudd, and they actually list them always pretty high on the return on investment because the amount that a lot of graduates get their first year coming out of college versus how much money they paid to go to Harvey Mudd is actually a really good return on investment. But if you go down that list, always down on the bottom are social work and educators. And it's hard to tell a student, education in the classroom is where you should be when you see them so far down on the list.
That's true. And let's talk a little bit about something like you call financial friendliness in terms of affording a cost of attendance. So we've done the whole financial aid episode before, so we won't go into cost of attendance. But how do we try to get these numbers down?
Well, and financial friendliness is that it's actually the term that collegedata.com uses for basically identifying a couple of numbers. And those are, they lump three numbers into that category of financial friendliness. And that's how much money historically does the college provide students, and how much do they cover in that financial need category. And one of the other numbers that they provide is how much money traditionally and historically have graduates graduated debt-wise, how much debt have they incurred over the 4 years or by the time that they graduate. And I think those numbers, how can you identify those schools that provide the best friendliness and also result in graduating with the least amount of debt? And I think that's a big part that more students and parents are looking forward to. How do they get that return on investment high and getting debt low?
Mm-hmm. And I think the other challenge is, I don't know if you see it in your area, but you know, I'm on different board groups in terms of answering questions for families. And this question of I'm too, quote unquote, rich for financial aid, but too poor to pay full sticker price, even though the school thinks I can or FAFSA thinks I can. Right. So they're caught, I guess, what I would say, between a rock and a hard place. And I think for that, you know, that's when you really have to target merit, right?
Yep. Well, and when you're working with students, and let's say they're in that category, that wonderful middle of the economic spectrum, and like you say, too rich to receive and too poor to pay for all. If you have a student and family that are in that situation, how do you identify the things that are most important and that and getting that percentage? What are the things that you look for in a college that will allow them that to get that most merit money? Where do you find that information?
I think that's a great question. I think there's a lot of great resources online, but I do already know of universities off the top of my head where I know, I hate to say that SAT scores or ACT scores matter, but unfortunately, when it comes to merit, it often does play a picture as well as the GPA. So fortunately, in my experience, if you do have students that have a certain range, then at certain schools, they will qualify. Not always, well, full ride is typically categorized as full cost of attendance, right? So you're getting tuition plus room and board and all that. But there's very few, we talked about it, unicorns that offer that. So it might just be full tuition, or even if it's half tuition, would that work for the family? And then from there, even let's say they get full tuition or half tuition, can the student look to become something like an RA down the line, and then they get free room and board? So starting to get a little creative with how to meet the gap in terms of not being offered financial aid in most situations. But I think the word of thumb almost is to look at schools that do actually offer merit scholarships
at all,
because a lot of universities do not do that. No, I shouldn't say that. I would say a lot of quote unquote well-ranked universities do not offer merit aid. But then to then look at what we would conditionally typically consider likely schools where their stats are way above. So they would be an exceptional student at that school, and that's where they would get the merit aid. But I think I would take it one step further, because I do believe in having students still be challenged. And that might not happen sometimes at a likely school. So unless they have something like an honors program. So that's really ideally what I like to consider the sweet spot, is finding an honors program at a good school that will pay them to come.
Exactly. I think the honors programs at a lot of big state schools, like here at the University of Washington, they have honors programs where if you can get into them, and especially if you're an in-state student, and I know students who have done this in Georgia as well. And basically, if you can get into a great institution that is a big institution with a lot of opportunities, and you can get into an honors program, your class sizes are small, your academic rigor is really high, you have much more contact with professors, you're basically getting a small college experience and education for an in-state tuition price. And I think that, you know, if you're talking return on investment, that's a good way to do it.
Mm-hmm. And then don't be surprised. I tell students sometimes, like sometimes you might actually pay less as an out-of-state student than in your own public school at another public school outside of the state where you might qualify again for like an honors program or merit. So don't always assume that just because you don't qualify for your state's merit that you wouldn't qualify for other states' merit.
Yeah, and schools may want, we know that schools try to diversify their student body, and basically they are looking for ways to do that and entertain applications from other states as well for many different reasons. And they know that that diversification in the classroom makes for a better conversation and more learning to occur and in an enriched environment. So you're, like you say, merit for in-state may be different for a student in a different state.
So, Mark, give us the quick and dirty on ROI in terms of what are the key questions parents should be asking.
Yeah, quick and dirty. I mean, one of the hard ones, and we've talked about this already, is can you really identify at least generally the area or the degree that you think you're going to get, because that's going to drive a lot of your choices in not only programs, but return on investment for schools and who's on their list. The other part of that is the area that you're going to work in, should you go to graduate school? And I think, you know, working in the sciences, I definitely tell students yes, basically because the return on investment is going to be to your advantage. Another part of that is the salary that you're going to earn in the areas that you are willing to work geographically. Are they equal throughout the country, or are they different in some areas than others? And be real honest about how much you're willing to sacrifice geographically in order to get the highest, you know, salary starting and increasing. Are you willing to move? Are you willing to go someplace that maybe isn't as illustrious as you'd like? And then probably the last one is look at your particular area that you're going to graduate in, hopefully work in. And what for that particular profession, is the pay increase over the next 5 years pretty steep, or is it pretty shallow? And that will have an influence on how quickly you can pay back your student debt or your loans and all of that. The other part of that, and the last thing that I remind students, because this is really something that hits home, what kind of a lifestyle do you expect to have after you graduate? And if you are paying back student loans that are so steep that you can't maintain any kind of, you know, of a lifestyle that you are either accustomed to or want to have, you have to factor that in and realize that if you're taking on a huge amount of debt, you may not be able to buy a house in 20 years. You may not be able to buy a new car for a while. And you may, your social events might be going out once a month, if that. So those are all those quick and dirty, hard questions that students need to explore before they identify schools that are going to go on the list.
Yes, I use that last one a lot, actually.
The lifestyle
one, because it's something that I've heard from a lot of people in my social circle, is that they wish they'd known that they would have to wait so much longer, for example, to buy a house or even family plan. So little things like that do play a role. But let's end with some good and bad examples of ROI investment.
Wait a second. You gave me a shiver. And do you actually mention family planning to a high school student that's headed to college and let them know, well, you know, you may have to put off, you know, having children. that scares me.
That's a funny one. No, I actually don't mention that, but I don't usually have to, because depending on the families I'm working with, some what I would say cultures prioritize family, which I understand. And so they'll actually bring it up to their kids.
Okay.
So especially if they are raising young women, that, you know, if you're going to do this and you're going to work and, you know, so for example, certain majors are not as conducive to someone who wants to be, you know, a very active member of their family while having a very driven career. For example, if you're going to go into investment banking and it requires 100 hours a week of work, it's not very likely you will see your family much. Or be able to establish a family very easily sometimes. So naturally, just working with certain families or parents, they will actually bring that up as well.
If you're working 100 hours a week, you're probably, establishing some of those community ties that allow you to actually think about a family probably aren't going to exist. So.
Yeah, and I talk to my students about not only the cost of, so A, in that profession, you make a lot of money and you make it quickly, but at what cost? Because I have a lot of friends whose health have suffered through certain careers that they've taken on. But I think, you just have to weigh the pros and cons like anything else.
Agreed. Well, you asked me for an example of an ROI that I would consider a bad choice. And these are real examples. So the one that, and it breaks my heart. So I've a student who wants to go into education, wants to be in the classroom, and they want to be as well prepared as possible and serve students in the best possible way. And they come in and they've got, say, like a 3.7 grade point, and they've got, you know, a 1300 SAT score, and they want to go to Harvard. And trying to let them understand that I understand you want to go to a really good school, but also let's do the return on investment and understand that, okay, with your grades and your SAT, if you can get in, you're going to graduate with, 150, 180 plus $1,000 of debt at an interest rate of, you know, an average, maybe of 5%. And the average, you know, national starting salary for a teacher graduating after 4 years, no matter where you come from, is probably going to be $25,000 to $30,000 a year. And your raise over the next, 5 years might be only $1,500 a year. So with those numbers, you can actually never pay back your return on investment at $180,000 of debt at that kind of salary. And I think that's something that you really don't want a student to dive into unknowingly.
That's a great point. I have one of those too, like real life examples, right? But you're counseling a student. I'm actually talking about people who've actually done it.
Okay.
So I've had a friend who went to an Ivy for education.
Yep.
And graduated with a six-figure debt. And, you know, God bless them. They are a professor. And I didn't realize how little professors made.
Yep.
Or how hard it is to find work as a professor, even when you do graduate from an Ivy. But I think that the challenging part was understanding that she had to look at other jobs just to make ends meet. So, and had to request a pause on payment of her loan, her student debt, because she couldn't even afford rent. So
yes.
I think it's really important to have those conversations before you end up like that.
I have a lot of those conversations with students who are considering education and going into teaching. And one of the big ones here living in Seattle, a lot of public school teachers can't live in Seattle because it costs too much.
Wow.
I know a lot of two teacher families where a husband and wife may have master's degrees and have some substantial education loans and debt that they've taken on, and both of them have another job in addition to their teaching job, which is almost unfathomable because I know how many hours go into the teaching position as it is. And that second job is merely to pay off the interest of their loans.
Wow.
So that's kind of the reality of this ROI that we're talking about. And I think going into it with eyes wide open and completely informed, so you don't make those kind of choices.
And Mark and I are not against teaching, by the way, just putting that out there.
More teachers.
But we do encourage you to find a good deal on your degree.
Yes, and where you go, again, that's the reason why the return on investment conversation is important, because you want to make sure that you graduate from a college that prepares you as best as possible for your profession, and you graduate with the least possible debt so that you can make other choices in life rather than just trying to figure out how you're going to pay off a student loan.
How about a good ROI?
Oh, the good ones. And these are the, like you say, let's make sure we get a warm, fluffy one out there.
Yeah.
Working with students in STEM, I can, after making sure that that's the direction they're heading or it's a high probability. If you graduate with a computer science degree today, and especially if you hang out for a master's degree in a particular area, say like cybersecurity, you are going to be able to pull in six figures easy and high six figures after a couple of years working in particular areas of the country. And I think if you're graduating with, basically I say, a rule of thumb I give to students and parents is, if the area that you're planning on working, if the average salary per year exceeds your, never take on more debt than the average first year salary that you will receive in that area. That's generally a rule of thumb. Of course, there's other considerations, but for somebody who's going into computer science and like cybersecurity, like I mentioned, with those kind of numbers that you can make immediately after school, you can take on considerable debt in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if you are intentional in the way that you pay it off, you can pay it off rather quickly.
Yes. Yes, that is a good point. And I'll end with one also. So I had a friend who did two graduate degrees at a very esteemed university. Yep. And I think she was close to $200,000 in debt afterwards. But she went into finance, yep. Which is a field that pays well. And with between the bonuses, I would say mostly the bonuses, a decent salary, she paid that off in, I think, 4 to 5 years.
Yep.
And then the rest is hers to keep. But I think, again, remember, certain areas like engineering or finance or other areas require you to put in a lot of time as well. So as you think about it, they make sense ROI financially. And as long as you have the health and the balance to do it, absolutely, go for it. So there are positive ROI stories out there.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that we both feel is really important, that when it's establishing that return on investment, that parents and students go into it as informed, and that's kind of what we do, as informed as possible, and also to answer those hard questions authentically and be real truthful about the realization of going into particular professions and taking on debt so that you know what you're getting into when you sign on the line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, absolutely. So I think the key is try to optimize ROI if that is a concern for your family. And I would say start that conversation early. Any closing thought for you, Mark?
Yeah, you just nailed it. Start that conversation early, because the more times you have to reflect and to do your research, the better off and better prepared you're going to be when you make that decision.
Great. Well, thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Anna.
Thanks for listening to the Coast to Coast College Admissions Podcast, where we make getting into college easy and fun. Don't forget to go over to iTunes and subscribe to get updated each week when we release a new episode. Also, for more helpful college admissions information, visit our website at www.c2ccollegepodcast.com.